aliens pose are too great. To think that we could harness them or treat them as equals was hubris, and the deaths we have seen already will be like a raindrop in the ocean. We've delivered ourselves into the hands of the devil. Not everyone understands that, but I think perhaps you do. To her surprise, she felt dread welling up in her throat. At the far end of the hall, metal clanked. Ashford's stall door swung open. One of the guards said something, but Cortez's full attention was on her, and it felt like pouring cool water on a burn. "I think I do," she said softly. "Captain Ashford's freedom is my doing, because he and I have come to a meeting of the minds that I could not manage with the present captain. When they began to bring the crews of the various ships together here, they did it in part by creating a weapon. Weapons don't work here. Light does, and they have made a weapon out of it. The communications laser has been made strong enough to cut through hulls, and it can be made stronger. Enough so, we believe, that it will destroy the ring and close the gate." "We'll be on the wrong side of it," Clarissa said. "Yes, but if we wait, others will come. They'll be tempted. If we can manipulate the gates, they'll say, what glories would come to us. I can already hear them."
"You were saying that.
You were one of them."
"I was. And I've learned a terrible lesson.
And you were driven here by hatred. Have you?" Ashford laughed. One of the guards said, "Welcome back, Captain." Clarissa tapped her fingertips against the bars and they chimed. "We were wrong," Cortez said. "But now we have a chance to make it right. We can protect all of humanity from making the mistakes we've made. We can protect them. But there will be a sacrifice. Us. All of us.
Yes.
We will die here in the darkness, cut off from all of those we have preserved. And among those who are with us here, we will be reviled. We may be punished, even put to death."
He shifted his hand to touch hers. The contact, skin to skin, was electric.
"I'm not lying to you, Clarissa. The things I am asking of you will have no reward in this life."
"What are you asking?" she said. "What do you want me to do about any of this?"
"People will try to stop us. They may try to kill the captain. I understand that the modifications made to your body have the potential to elevate your natural abilities to something exceptional. Come with us. See to it that the captain isn't hurt, and that he isn't stopped. It may be you need to do nothing but stand witness. Or you may be the difference between success and failure."
"Either way, I'm dead."
"Yes. But one will only be a death. The other will have meaning."
Captain Ashford and his guards began walking toward them. The click of their heels against the deck was like the soft sounds of a mechanical clock. The moment drew toward its end, and resentment burned a little. She didn't want Ashford to come. She wanted to stay here, talking with the Reverend about sacrifice and death, about the burden of having done something so wrong the scales couldn't be balanced while she lived. Even though his mouth was set, Cortez's pale blue eyes smiled at her. He didn't look like her father at all. His face was too doughy. His jaw was too wide. He was all sincerity, where her father always had a sense of laughing at the world from behind a mask. But at that moment, she saw Jules Pierre Mao in him. "The people we killed," she said. "If we do this, all of them will have died for a reason too."
"For the noblest of reasons," Cortez agreed. "We have to get going," Ashford said.
and Cortez stepped back from the doorway, folding his hands together. Ashford turned to her. His too large head and thin Belter's frame made him seem like something from a bad dream.
"Last chance," he said.
"I'll go," Clarissa said.
Ashford's eyebrows rose, and he glanced from her to Cortez and back. A slow smile stretched his lips.
"You're sure?" he asked,
but the pleasure in his voice made it clear he wasn't really looking for her thoughts or justifications.
"I'll make sure no one stops you," she said.
Ashford looked at Cortez for a moment, and his expression showed that he was impressed. He saluted her, and, awkwardly, she saluted back. She felt a moment's disorientation stepping out of her cell that didn't come from a change in gravity or Coriolis. It was the first free step she'd taken since the Rocinante. Ashford walked ahead of her, his two guards talking about action groups and locking down the behemoth. Engineering and command weren't in the rotating drum, and so they would take control of the transfer points at the far north and south of the drum and the exterior elevator that passed between them. How to maintain calm in the drum until they could lock it all down. Who was tracking the enemy? Who was already a loyalist? And who would need persuasion? Clarissa didn't pay much attention. She was more aware of Cortez walking at her side and the sense of having left some kind of burden behind in the cell. She was going to die, and it was going to make all the things she'd done wrong before make sense. Every child born on Earth or Mars or the stations of the Belt would be safe from the protomolecule because of what they were about to do. And Soledad, and Bob, and Stani, her father and her mother, and her siblings, they would all know she was dead. Everyone who'd known and loved Ren would be able to sleep a little better knowing that his killer had come to justice. Even she'd sleep better, if she got any sleep.
"And she has combat implants," Ashford was saying as he pointed his fist back toward her. One of the guards looked back toward her, the one with off-colored eyes and the scar on his chin. Jojo. "You're sure she's one of us, Captain?"
"The enemy of my enemy, Jojo," Ashford said.
"I will vouch for her," Cortez said.
"You shouldn't," Clarissa thought, but didn't say.
"Claro," Jojo said with a Belter gesture equivalent to a shrug. "She's on command deck with two Alice too."
"That'll be fine," Ashford said. The hall opened into a larger corridor. White LEDs left the walls looking pale and antiseptic. A dozen people armed with slug throwers, men and women both, sat in electric carts or stood beside them. Clarissa wanted the air itself to smell different, but it didn't. It was all just plastic and heat. Captain Ashford and the three armed men jostled in the cart just ahead.
"It will take some time before the ship is fully secured," Cortez said. "We'll have to gather what allies we can, suppress the resistance. Once we assemble everything we need and get off the drum, they won't be able to stop us."
He sounded like he was trying to talk himself into believing something.
"Don't be afraid. This has all happened for a reason. If we have faith, there is nothing to fear."
"I'm not afraid," Clarissa said.
Cortez looked over at her, a smile in his eyes. When he met her gaze, the smile faltered a little. He looked away.
Chapter 38. Bull.
Bull tried not to cough. The doctor listened to his breath, moved the stethoscope a few inches, listened some more. He couldn't tell if the little silver disc was cold. He couldn't feel it. He coughed up a hard knob of mucus and accepted a bit of tissue from the doctor to spit it into. She tapped a few notes into her hand terminal. The light from its screen showed how tired she looked.
"Well, you're clearing a little,"
the doctor said. Your white count is still through the roof, though.
And the spine?
Your spine is a mess, and it's getting worse. By which I mean it's getting harder to make better.
That's a sacrifice.
When's it going to be enough? She asked.
Depends on what you mean by it, Bull said.
You wanted to get everyone together.
They're together. Still got crews on half the ships.
Skeleton crews, the doctor said. I know how many people you have on this ship. I treat them. You wanted to bring everyone together, they're together. Is that enough?
Be nice to make sure everyone doesn't just start shooting at each other, Bull said.
The doctor lifted her hands, exasperated. So, as soon as humans aren't humans anymore, then you'll let me do my job. Bull laughed, which was a mistake. His cough was deeper now, rattling in the caverns of his chest, but it wasn't violent. Before he could really work up a good gut-wrencher, he'd need abdominal muscles that fired. The doctor handed him another tissue. He used it.
We get everything under control, he said. You can knock me out, all right?
Is that going to happen? She asked. It was the thing everyone wanted to know, whether they came right out and said it or not. The truth was, he didn't like the plan. Part of that was because it came from Jim Holden. Part was that it came from the protomolecule, and part was that he badly wanted it to be true. The fallback was that he'd start evacuating who he could with the shuttles he had, except that shuttles weren't built for long-haul work. It wasn't viable. They had to start making food, generating soil to fill the interior of the drum, growing crops under the false strip of sun that ran along the behemoth's axis, and getting the goddamned heat under control. He had to see to it that they made it, whatever that meant. Medical comas could last a pretty long time when ships slower than a decent fastball made a voyage across emptiness wider than Earth's oceans. All of the reasons they'd come out, Earth, Mars, the OPA, all of them seemed almost impossibly distant. Worrying about the OPA's place and the political calculus of the system was like trying to remember whether he'd paid back a guy who bought him a beer when he was 20. After a certain point, the past becomes irrelevant. Nothing that happened outside the slow zone mattered. All that counted now was keeping things civilized until they found out if Holden's mad plan was more than a pipe dream. And in order to do that, he had to keep breathing.
Might pull it off. Captain Pa's got a plan she's looking at, might get us burning again. Maybe, he said. While we're waiting, though, you think you could hook me up?
She scowled, but she got an inhaler from the pack beside the bed and tossed it to him. His arm still worked. He shook the thing twice, then put the formed ceramics to his lips and breathed. The steroids smelled like the ocean, and they burned a little. He tried not to cough. That's not going to fix anything, she said. All we're doing is masking the symptoms.
It's just got to get me through, Bo said, trying out a smile.
The truth was, he felt like crap. He didn't hurt. He just felt tired and sick and desperate. With the inhaler stowed, he angled the walker back out toward the corridor. The medical bays were still full. The growing heat gave everything the sick, close feeling of a tropical summer. The smell of bodies and illness, blood and corruption, and fake floral antiseptics made the rooms feel smaller than they were. Practice had made him more graceful with the mechanism. He used the two joysticks to shift out of the way of the nurses and therapists, making himself as unobtrusive as the rig allowed as he made his way back toward the security office. His hand terminal chimed. He drove to a turn in the corridor, snugging himself into the corner to stay out of the way, then dropped the joysticks and took up the terminal. Corin requesting a connection. He thumbed to accept.
Corin, he said. What you got?
Boss, she said. The tension in her voice brought his head up a degree. You running a drill?
What's going on?
Jojo and Goodman's daughter just came by and said they were taking over the security office. When I told them they could have it when my shift was up, they drew down on me.
Bull felt a black dread descending upon him. He gripped the terminal and kept his voice low.
They what?
He pulled up his security interface, but the red border refused him. He was locked out of the command systems. They'd been moving fast.
Was hoping it was some kind of test. Where they were talking, I got the feeling they were looking to find you there. I'm heading over to Serge's. He's trying to figure out what the hell's going on, she said. If it was the wrong call.
It wasn't. You walked away, you did the right thing. Where were they supposed to be?
Sir?
They were on shift. Where were they supposed to be?
For a moment, Corin's wide face was a mask of confusion. He watched her understand, a calm and deadly focus coming into her eyes. She didn't need to say it. Jojo and Gutman's daughter had been guarding the prisoners, meaning Ashford. Pa should have let him kill the bastard.
Okay, find Serge and anyone you trust. We've got to get this shit contained.
Bien.
They'd go for the armory. If they had security, the guns and gear were already theirs. Bull let a thin trickle of conversational obscenities fall from his lips while he tried to think. If he knew how many of his people had turned back to Ashford, he'd know what he had to work with.
We can't let him get to Monica and the broadcast center, Bull said. It gets out that we've got fighting in the drum. We'll get a dozen half-assed rescue missions trying to get their people out.
You want us to concentrate there? Corin asked.
Don't concentrate anywhere, Bull said. Not until we know what we're looking at. Just get as many people and guns as you can and stay in touch.
He had to get a plan. He had to have one now, only his brain wasn't working the way it should. He was sick. Hell, he was dying. It seemed deeply unfair that he should have to improvise at the same time.
Get to Serge, he said. We'll worry about it from there. I've got some people I've got to talk to.
Bien, boss, Corin repeated, and dropped the connection.
A nurse pushed a rolling table around the corner, and Bull had to put his terminal away in order to step out of the man's path. He wished like hell he could walk and hold his hand terminal at the same damn time. He requested a priority connection to Pa. For a long moment, he was sure she wouldn't pick up. That Ashford had gotten to her already. The screen flickered, and she was there. He couldn't see what room she was in, but there were voices speaking in the background.
Mr. Baca, Pa said.
Ashford's loose, he said. I don't know how many people he's got or what he's doing, but a couple of my people just drew weapons and took over the security station.
Pa blinked. To her credit, she didn't show even a moment's fear, only the mental shifting of gears.
Thank you, Mr. Baca, Pa said.
He could tell from the movement of her image on the screen that she was already walking away from wherever she'd been, getting someplace unpredictable. That was what he needed to be doing, too.
I'll try to get in touch when I have a better idea what I'm looking at, he said.
I appreciate that, she said. I have a few people nearby that I trust. I'm going there now.
I figure he's going to try to take over the broadcast station.
Then we'll try to reinforce them, Pa said.
Maybe it's just a few assholes, Bull said. Ashford may be trying to keep his head low too.
Or he may be getting ready to throw us both into a soil recycler, Pa said. Which way do you want to bet?
Bull smiled. He almost meant it.
Take care of yourself, Captain.
You too, Mr. Baca.
And hey, he said, I'm sorry I got you into this.
Now it was Pa's turn to smile. She looked tired. She looked old.
You didn't make any decisions for me, she said. If I'm paying for my sins, at least give me that they're mine. Her gaze jumped up from the terminal's camera towards something off the screen. Her lips pressed thin, and the connection dropped. Bull had to fight not to request another connection, just so he could know what happened. But there wasn't time. He had to hurry. He tried connections to Ruiz in infrastructure and Chen without getting replies. He wondered how many supporters Ashford had gotten from the upper ranks of the staff. He cursed himself for having let Ashford pass under his radar. But he'd been so busy. He tried Sam, and almost as soon as he put in the request, she was there.
We've got a problem, he said. Ashford's trying to take back the ship. He's got security already.
And engineering, Sam said. Beau licked his lips.
Where are you, Sam?
Right now? Funny you should ask. Engineering. Ashford left about 5 minutes ago. Had a little wish list of things he'd like me to do and about 2 dozen fellas with guns and scowls. That man's lost his shit, Bull. Seriously. He used to be a prick, but he wants me to take out the ring. Your comm laser trick? He wants it overclocked.
You gotta be kidding me.
Not.
He's looking to nuke the way home?
Calls it saving humanity from the alien threat, Sam said sweetly. Her eyes were hard.
All right, Bull said, even though nothing about this was all right.
And he's not at all happy with you. Are you someplace safe?
Bull looked up and down the corridor. There wasn't cover. And even if there was, he was one man in a modified lifting mech and no spinal cord past the middle of his back.
No, he said. I don't think I am.
Might want to get moving.
I've got no place safe to go, Bull said.
Someone on the other end of the connection shouted, and Sam looked up at them.
I'm trying to scramble up all the technicians I can, she shouted back. Things have been a tiny bit disorganized. Had a little trouble with the rules of physics changing on us. Maybe you noticed?
The first voice shouted again. Bull couldn't hear the words, but he knew the timbre of the voice. Garza, the guy who'd always gotten bulbs of coffee for whoever was stuck in the security office. Garza was one of theirs. Bull wished he'd gotten to know the man better. Especially after the catastrophe, he should have been checking in with his staff more. He should have seen all this coming. This was his fault. All of this was his fault. Sam looked back down at the screen, at him.
Okay, sweetie, she said. You should get scarce. Head for the second level, Section M. There's a bunch of empty storage there. The door codes are all in default, straight zeros.
Why are they on default?
Because there's nothing in them, bossy pants. And changing the locks on all the empties never made the top of my to-do list. Is this really the time?
Sorry, Bull said.
Don't worry, she said. Both of us under a little stress right now. Just get your head down before someone knocks it off. And Pa?
Pa knows. She's heading for safety too.
All right then. I'll try to get you some help.
No, Bull said. You don't know who you can trust.
Yes, I do, Sam said. Let's don't argue in front of the children.
A voice brought him back to the corridor, the medical center. Not the groans of the wounded, not the professional calm of the nurses. Someone was excited and aggressive, angry. Someone answered in a lower voice, and the first one came back with, "Do I look like I care?" It was trouble, and despite everything, his first impulse was to turn toward it. His job was to get into the middle of things, to make sure that no one got hurt, and if anyone did, it was him. Him first, then the bad guys.
I got to go, he said, and dropped the connection.
It only took a second to stow his hand terminal and get his palms back on the mech's controls, long enough for him to fight back his instincts. He shifted the mech to head down the corridor, away from the voices. They were Ashford's people, Ashford and whoever was backing him. If he got caught now, he wouldn't be any use to anybody. Chances were they'd just kill him. Might not even get as far as the airlock first. The mech's legs moved slowly. Even full out, it didn't go more than a modest walk. The voices behind him shifted. Something crashed. He heard his doctor shouting now, and waited for the report of gunfire. If they started shooting, he'd have to go back. The mech inched toward the farther door, toward the exit and what passed for safety. Bull pressed the joystick forward so hard his fingers ached, as if the force would make the machine understand the danger. The voices got louder, coming close. Bull shifted the mech so that it was walking along the wall. If someone came around the corner behind him, it would give him an extra fraction of a second before he was seen. The thick metal legs slid forward, shifted weight, shifted again. The doorway was 6 feet away. 4. 3. He let go of the controls and reached out for the door a little too soon and had to inch the mech forward before he tried again. He was sweating, and he hoped it was only fear. If something in his guts had given way, he wouldn't have known. Probably it was just fear. The door opened, and he slammed the little joystick forward again. The mech took him through, and he closed the door behind him. He didn't have time to wait or think. He angled the mech down another hall toward the internal lifts and the long trip to second level, Section M. The great interior halls and passageways of the behemoth had never seemed less like home. As he descended, the spin gravity grew almost imperceptibly stronger. His numb flesh sat a little heavier in its harness. He was going to have to get someone to change out his piss bag soon, unless he could figure out some way to get his arms inside the mech's frame. But his elbows only bent one direction, so that seemed unlikely. And if his spine didn't grow back, if they didn't get the behemoth and everyone else back out of the trap the protomolecule had caught them in, he'd live like this until he died. "Don't think about it," he told himself. "Too far ahead. Don't think about it. Just do your job." He didn't take one of the main internal lifts. Chances were too good that Ashford's men would be watching for that. Instead, he found one of the long, spiraling maintenance passages and set the mech to walking on its own. If it drifted too near one wall or the other, he could correct it, but it gave him a few seconds. He pulled out the hand terminal. He was shaking, and his skin looked gray under the brown. Serge answered almost immediately. "Gute Nacht, boss," the tattooed belter said. "Was wondering when you were going to check in." "Ashford," Bull said. "On top of it," Serge said. "Looks like he's got about a third of our boys, and a bunch of crazy-ass coyos from other ships. Right now they got the transition points off the drum north to command and south to engineering. The security office and the armory is some little wolf packs going through the drums, stirring up trouble." "How well armed?" "Nicht so bien comme moi," Serge said, grinning. "They savvy they got us locked out of the communications, too, but I got back door open."
"You what?"
"Always ready for merde mal, me. Bust me down later," Serge said. "I'm putting together squads. Clean up the drum. We'll get this all smashed flat by bedtime."
"You have to be careful with these guys, Serge."
"Will, boss.
Know what we're doing. Know the ship better than anyone. You get safe. Let us take care."
Bull swallowed. Giving over control ached.
"Okay.
We've been trying to get the captain us," Serge said.
"I warned her. She may be refusing connections until she knows more who she can trust," Bull said. He didn't add, "or they may have found her."
"Check," Serge said. And Bull heard in the man's voice that he'd had the same thought.
"When we track Ashford?" "We don't have permission to kill him," Bull said. "A finger slips.
Think we can get forgiveness?
Probably.
Serge grinned. Got to go, boss.
Just when Ese Cerrado and they make UXO, keep me in mind for your chair, no?
Screw that, Bull said. When this shit's done, you can be XO.
Hold you too, boss, Serge said, and the connection went dead.
Chapter 39. Anna. The first sermon Anna had delivered in front of a congregation, fresh out of seminary and filled with zeal, was 17 pages of single-spaced notes. It had been a lengthy dissection of the first chapter of Malachi, focusing on the prophet's exhortation not to deliver substandard sacrifices to God, and how that related to modern worship. It had been detailed, backed by all of the evidence and argument Anna's studious nature and 7 years of graduate school could bring to bear. By the end of it, Anna was pretty sure not one member of the audience was still awake. She'd learned some important lessons from that. There was a place for detailed Bible scholarship. There was even a place for it in front of the congregation. But it wasn't what people came to church for. Learning a bit more about God was part of feeling closer and more connected to Him. And the closeness was what mattered. So Anna's sermons now tended to be just a page or two of notes, and a lot more speaking from the heart. She'd delivered her message on mixed churches in God's eyes without looking at the notes once, and it seemed to go over very well. After she concluded with a short prayer and began the sacrament, belters and Martians and earthers got in line together in companionable silence. A few shook hands or clapped each other on the back. Anna felt like it might be the most important message she'd ever delivered.
Well, it wasn't the worst thing I've ever heard, Tilly said once the service was over. She had the twitchy look she got when she wanted a cigarette, but Anna had asked her not to smoke in the meeting tent, and she'd agreed. Though admittedly, my tolerance for lovely togetherness is low.
That's very flattering, Anna whispered, then paused to shake hands with a belter woman who tearfully thanked her for organizing the meeting.
Tilly gave the woman her most insincere smile, but managed not to roll her eyes.
I need a drink, Tilly said once the woman had left.
Come with. I'll buy you a lemonade.
They closed the bar. Rationing. Tilly laughed. I have a supplier. The guy running the rationing sold me a bottle of their best Ganymede hooch for the low price of $1,000. He tossed in the lemonade for free.
$1,000?
One of two things will happen, Tilly said, taking out a cigarette and putting it in her mouth but leaving it unlit. We'll get out of here, back into the solar system where I'm rich and $1,000 doesn't matter, or we won't get out and nothing will matter.
Anna nodded because she didn't know what else to say.
As much as she'd come to enjoy and rely on Tilly's friendship, she was occasionally reminded how utterly different their worlds were. If she and Nono had an extra $1,000 lying around, it would have immediately gone into Nami's college fund. Tilly had never in her life had to sacrifice a luxury to get a necessity. If there was any actual mixing in the congregation, it was that. The one thing the belters and inner planet naval people had in common was that none of them would be drinking $1,000 alcohol that night. But Tilly would. God might not care about financial standing, but he was the only one.
I admit, lemonade sounds nice, Anna said, fanning her face with her hand terminal.
The behemoth's big habitat drum was built to house a lot more people than it currently held, but they'd stripped a lot of the environmental systems out of it when they converted it to a warship. It was starting to seem like they were reaching the atmosphere processing limits. Or maybe just the air conditioning. The temperature was generally higher now than a girl raised in Russia and most recently living on one of Jupiter's icy moons enjoyed.
After one more tour of the tent to say goodbye to the last lingering remnants of her congregation, Anna followed Tilly out. It wasn't much cooler outside the tent, but the spin of the drum and the air recycling system did combine to create a gentle breeze. Tilly looked over her flushed red face and sweat-plastered hair with a critical eye and said, "Don't worry, everyone who's coming over is here. I heard Cortez talking to some OPA bigwig a couple days ago. This is as hot as it's going to be. And as soon as they find a way to cool us down, that doesn't involve venting our atmosphere into space, they'll do it." Anna couldn't help but laugh. When Tilly raised an eyebrow, Anna explained, "We flew across the entire solar system, almost to the orbit of Neptune, a world so cold and distant from the sun, we didn't even know it was there until Bouvard noticed that something was bumping Uranus around." Tilly's eyebrow crept higher. "Okay. And when we get here, who knows how far from the sun and with billions of kilometers of empty space in every direction, we somehow manage to be hot and crowded." "Thank God the Belters thought to bring this rattle trap with them," Tilly said, ducking to enter her tent. She flopped down into a folding chair and started rummaging in a plastic cooler next to it. "Can you imagine trying to stuff everyone onto the Prince? We'd be 12 to a bunk there. Lovely culture, these Belters." Anna pulled her cassock off and laid it over the edge of Tilly's cot. Underneath, she was wearing a white blouse and a knee-length skirt that was much less stifling. Tilly pulled a plastic bulb of lemonade out of the cooler and handed it to her, then poured herself a glass of something as clear as water that smelled like hospital cleanser. When Anna took the bulb, she was surprised to find it cold. Small drops of condensation were already forming on its surface. She put the cool bottle against the back of her neck and felt a delightful chill run down her spine. "How did you manage ice?" "Dry ice," Tilly said around a lit cigarette, then paused to down her first shot. "Apparently it's easy for the people in atmosphere processing to make. Lots of carbon dioxide just lying around." If Tilly was spending $1,000 a bottle for the antiseptic she was drinking, Anna didn't want to know what a steady supply of ice was costing her. They drank in companionable silence for a while, the cool lemonade doing wonders for Anna's heat exhaustion. Tilly brought up the idea of finding something to eat, and they wandered out of her tent in search of a supply kiosk. There were people walking through the crowded tent city, carrying guns. "This looks bad," Tilly said. It did. These weren't bored security officers with holstered sidearms. These were grim-faced Belter men and women with assault rifles and shotguns carried in white-knuckled grips. The group moving between the tents was at least a dozen strong, and they were looking for something. Or someone. Anna tugged at Tilly's sleeve. "Maybe we should try to get people to go back to the church tent to wait this out. Annie, if the bullets start flying in here, even God can't make that tent a safe place to hide. I want to know what's going on." Anna reluctantly followed her in a path that paralleled the armed group, which moved with purpose, occasionally stopping to look in tents or quietly question people. Anna began to feel very frightened without being sure why. "Oh," Tilly said, "here we go." Bull's second in command, Serge was his name, Anna thought, rounded one of the larger tents, trailing half a dozen security people behind him. They were all armed as well, though only with handguns. Even to Anna's untrained eye, the difference between 6 people with pistols and 12 people with rifles was dramatic. Serge had a faint smile on his face, as though he hadn't noticed. Anna saw the muscular young woman from the security office standing behind him, though her face was a worried scowl. Oddly enough, seeing someone else look worried made Anna feel better. "No guns in the drums, Sasa," Serge said to the armed Belter group, though the volume in his voice made it clear he was speaking to the onlookers as well.
Drop 'em.
You have guns, a Belter woman said with a sneer. She held a rifle at the ready.
We're the cops,
Serge said, placing one hand on the butt of his gun and grinning back at her.
Not anymore,
she replied, and in one quick movement shifted her rifle and shot him in the head. A tiny hole appeared in his forehead, and a cloud of pink mist sprayed into the air behind him. He sank slowly to the floor, an expression of vague puzzlement on his face. Anna felt her gorge rise, and had to double over and pant to keep from vomiting. Jesus Christ, Tilly said in a strangled whisper. The speed with which the situation had gone from unsettling to terrifying took Anna's breath away. I've just seen a man have his brains blown out. Even after the horrors of the slow zone catastrophe, it was the worst thing she'd ever seen. The security man hadn't thought the woman would shoot him, hadn't suspected the true nature of the threat, and the price he'd paid for it was everything. At that thought, Anna threw up all over her shoes and then sank to her knees, gagging. Tilly dropped down next to her, not even noticing that the knees of her pants were in a pool of vomit. Tilly hugged her for a second, then whispered, "We need to go." Anna nodded back because she couldn't open her mouth without fear of losing control again. A few dozen meters away, the Belters were disarming the security team and tying their arms behind their backs with plastic strips. At least they weren't shooting anyone else. Tilly pulled her to her feet, and they hurried back to her tent, all thought of food forgotten. "Something very bad is happening on this ship," Tilly said. Anna had to suppress a manic giggle. Given their current circumstances, things would have to be very bad indeed for Tilly to think the situation had gotten worse. Sure, they were all trapped in orbit around an alien space station that periodically changed the rules of physics and had killed a bunch of them. But now, they'd decided to start shooting each other, too. Yes, very bad. Hector Cortez came to Tilly's tent about an hour after the shooting. Anna and Tilly had spent the time staying as close to the floor of the tent as possible, arranging Tilly's few bits of furniture into barricades around them. It had the feeling of performing ritual magic. Nothing in the room would actually stop a bullet, but they arranged it anyway. A blanket fort to keep the monsters at bay. Mercifully, there hadn't been any further sounds of gunfire. The few times they peeked out of the tent, they saw smaller groups of no more than two or three armed Belters patrolling the civilian spaces. Anna avoided meeting their eyes, and they ignored her. When Cortez arrived, he cleared his throat loudly outside the tent, then asked if he could enter. They were both afraid to answer, but he came in anyway. Several people waited for him outside, though Anna couldn't see who. He glanced once around the inside of the gloomy space, looking over their flimsy barricade, then pulled a chair away from it and sat down without commenting on it.
"The shooting is over. It's safe to sit," he said, gesturing at the other chairs.
He looked better than he had in a while. His suit had been cleaned, and somehow he'd found a way to wash his thick white hair. But that wasn't all of it. Some of his self-assurance had returned. He seemed confident and in charge again. Anna climbed up off the floor and took a chair. After a moment, Tilly did the same.
"I'm sorry you were frightened," Cortez said with a smile that didn't seem sorry at all.
"What's going on, Hank?" Tilly asked, her eyes narrowing. She took out a cigarette and began playing with it without lighting it. "What are you up to?"
"I'm not up to anything, Matilda," Cortez said. "What's happening is that the rightful authority of this ship has been restored, and Captain Ashford is once more in command."
"Okay, Hector," Tilly replied,
But how are you involved? Seems like internal OPA politics to me. What's your play?
Cortez ignored her and said to Anna, Dr. Volovodov, may we speak privately?
Tilly can hear anything. Anna started, but Tilly waved her off. I think I'll go outside for a smoke.
When she'd left the tent, Cortez pulled his chair close enough that his knees were almost touching Anna's. He leaned forward, taking her hands in his own. Anna had never had the sense that Hector was interested in her sexually, and still didn't. But somehow the closeness felt uncomfortably intimate, invasive.
Anna, he said, giving her hands a squeeze, things are about to change dramatically on this ship, and in our calling here. I've been fortunate in that Captain Ashford trusts me and has sought my counsel, so I've had some input on the direction these changes take.
The forced intimacy, combined with the bitter taste still in her mouth from having seen a man murdered, brought up an anger she hadn't expected. She pulled her hands away from him with more violence than she intended, then couldn't help but feel a twinge of satisfaction at the hurt and surprise on his face.
How nice for you, she said, carefully keeping her tone neutral. Dr. Volovodov,
Anna, I would like your support. Anna couldn't stop the snort of disbelief in time, but he pressed on. You have a way with people. I'm fine in front of a camera, but I'm not as good one-on-one. And that's where you shine. That's your gift. And we are about to face terrible personal challenges. Things people have a hard time understanding. I would like your voice there with me to reassure them.
What are you talking about? Anna said, barely squeezing the words past a growing lump in her throat. She had the sense of a terrible secret about to be revealed.
Cortez shone with the invincible certainty of the true believer.
We are going to close the gate, he said. We have a weapon in our possession that we believe will work.
No, Anna said, more in disbelief than in denying his claims.
Yes. Even now, engineers work to refit this vessel's communications laser to make it powerful enough to destroy the ring.
I don't mean that, Anna started, but Cortez just continued speaking.
We are lost, but we can protect those we left behind. We can end the greatest threat the human race has ever known. All it requires is that we sacrifice any hope of return. A small price to pay for...
No, Anna said again, more forcefully.
No, you don't get to decide that for all these people.
For me, she thought. You don't get to take my wife and daughter away like that, just because you're afraid.
In times of great danger and sacrifice such as this, some will step forward to make the difficult decisions. Ashford has done that, and I support him. Now it is our role to make sure the people understand and cooperate. They need to know that their sacrifice will protect the billions of people we've left behind.
We don't know that, Anna said. This station has already claimed hundreds of lives, maybe thousands, because we keep making decisions without knowing what the consequences are. We chased Holden's ship through the ring. We sent soldiers to the station to hunt him. We keep acting without information and then being angry when it hurts us.
It didn't hurt us. It killed us, a lot of us.
We're like children, Anna said, pushing herself to her feet and lecturing down at him, who burn their hands on a hot stove and then think the solution is to blow up all the stoves.
Eros, Cortez started.
We did that, and Ganymede, and Phoebe, all the rest. We did it. We keep acting without thinking, and you think the solution is to do it one more time. You have allied yourself with stupid, violent men, and you are trying to convince yourself that being stupid and violent will work. That makes you stupid, too.
I will never help you. I'll fight you now.
Cortez stood up and called to the people waiting outside. A belter with protective chest armor and a rifle came into the tent.
Will you shoot me too? Anna said, putting as much contempt into the words as she could.
Cortez turned his back on her and left with the gunman. Anna sank down into her chair, her legs suddenly too shaky to support her. She doubled over, rocking back and forth and taking long, shuddering breaths to calm herself. Somehow, she didn't black out.
Did he hurt you? Tilly said from behind her.
Her friend put a gentle hand on the back of her neck as she rocked.
No,
Anna said. It was technically a lie.
Oh, Annie, they have Claire. They wouldn't let me talk to her. I don't know if she's a hostage or...
Before she knew she was going to do it, Anna had jumped to her feet and run out of the tent. They'd be going to the elevator that ran up the side of the drum and connected the passages to the command decks and engineering. They'd be going to the bridge. Men like Cortez and Ashford, men who wanted to be in charge, they'd be on the bridge. She ran toward the elevator as fast as her legs would carry her. She hadn't actually run in years. Living in a small station tunneled into the ice of Europa, it just hadn't come up. She was out of breath in moments, but pushed on, ignoring the nausea and the stitch in her ribs. She reached the elevator just as Cortez and his small band of gun-toting thugs climbed inside. Clarissa was standing at the back of the group, looking small and frail, surrounded by soldiers in armor. As the door slid closed, she smiled at Anna and raised one hand in a wave. Then she was gone.
Chapter 40. Holden.
Hey, Cap, Amos said from his bed. That was the third armed patrol that's gone past this room in about 3 hours. Some shit is going down.
I know, Holden said quietly. It was obvious that the situation on the behemoth had changed. People with guns were moving through the corridors with hard expressions. Some of them had pulled a doctor aside, had a short but loud argument with her, then taken a patient away in restraints. It felt like a coup in progress. But according to Naomi, the security chief Bull had already mutinied and taken the ship from the original Belter captain. And nothing had happened that would explain why he'd suddenly need to put a lot more boots on the ground or begin making arrests. It felt like a civil war was brewing, or being squashed.
Should we do something? Amos asked.
Yes, Holden thought. We should do something. We should get back to the Rocinante and hide until Miller gets done whatever he was doing and releases the ships in the slow zone. Then they should burn like hell out of this place and never look back. Unfortunately, his crew was still laid up, and he didn't exactly have a ride waiting to take him to his ship.
No, he said instead. Not until we understand what's happening. I just got out of jail, not in a hurry to go back.
Alex sat up in bed, and then moaned at the effort. The top of his head was swathed in blood-stained bandages, and the left side of his face had a mushy, pulpy look to it. The speed limit change had thrown him face first into one of the cockpit's view screens. If he hadn't been at least partially belted into his chair, he'd probably be dead.
Maybe we should find a quieter place than this to hole up, he said. They don't seem opposed to arresting patients so far.
Holden nodded with his fist. He was starting to pick up Naomi's belter-style gestures, but whenever he caught himself using one, he felt awkward, like a kid pretending to be an adult.
My time on this ship has been limited to the docking bay and this room. I don't have any idea where a quieter place would be.
Well, Naomi said, that puts you one up on us. None of us were conscious when they brought us here. Holden hopped off the edge of her bed and moved to the door, closing it as quietly as possible.
He looked around for something to jam it shut with, but quickly decided it was hopeless. The habitation spaces in the behemoth's drum were built for low weight, not durability. The walls and door of the hospital room were paper-thin layers of epoxy and woven carbon fiber. A good kick would probably bring the entire structure down. Barricading the door would only signal patrols that something was wrong, and then delay them half a second while they broke it.
"Maybe that preacher can help us," Alex said.
"Yeah," Amos said. "Red seems like good people."
"No hitting on the preacher," Holden said, pointing at Amos with an accusing finger.
But it doesn't matter, because if she has even half a brain, and I suspect she has a lot more than that, she'll be busily hiding herself. And she's not from here. We need an insider."
"Sam," Naomi said, just as Holden was thinking the same name. "She's chief engineer on this boat. No one will know it like she does."
"Does she owe you any favors?" Holden asked. Naomi gave him a sour look and pulled his hand terminal off his belt.
"No, I owe her about 1,000, she said as she opened a connection request to Sam. "But she's a friend. Favors don't matter."
She laid the terminal on the bed with a speaker on. The triple beep of an unanswered voice request sounding once a second. Alex and Amos were staring at it intensely, eyes wide, as though it were a bomb that might go off at any moment. In a way, Holden thought it was. They were about as helpless right now as he could ever remember them being. Holden found himself wishing that Miller would appear and fix everything with alien magic.
"Yo," a voice said from the terminal. "Knuckles."
At some point over the last year, Sam had given Naomi the nickname Knuckles. Holden had never been able to figure out why, and Naomi had never offered to explain.
"Sammy," Naomi replied, the relief in her voice obvious. "We really, really need your help."
"Funny," Sam said. "I was just thinking of coming by to ask for your help. Coincidence? Or something more?"
"We were calling you to find the hiding spot," Amos yelled out. "If you were calling us for the same thing, you're fucked."
"No, that's a good idea. I've got a spot you can hole up for a while, and I'll come meet you there. Knuckles, you'll have the layout in just a second. Just follow the map. I'll be there as soon as I can. You kids take care of yourselves."
"You do the same, Sammy," Naomi said, then killed the connection.
She worked the terminal for a few seconds.
"Okay, I see it. Looks like unused storage just a couple 100 meters aft and spinward."
"You get to navigate," Holden said to her, then added, "Can everyone walk?"
Amos and Alex both nodded, but Naomi said, "Alex's skull is being held together with glue right now. If he gets dizzy and falls, he's not getting up again."
"Now, XO," Alex objected.
Naomi can't walk," Amos said.
"So you put her on a rolling bed with Alex and push them. I'll take point. Give me that map."
Holden didn't argue. He picked Naomi up from her bed, trying to jostle her as little as possible, then set her next to Alex on his.
"Why am I pushing instead of walking point?"
"He broke his left arm," Naomi said, scooting as close to Alex as possible and then securing the lap restraint across them both. When Amos began to protest, she added, "And all the ribs on his left side."
"Right," Holden said, grabbing the push bars at the head of the bed and kicking off the wheel locks. "Lead the way."
Amos led them through the makeshift hospital corridors, smiling at everyone he passed, moving with an easy stride that made him look like a man with a destination but no hurry to get there. Even the armed patrol they passed barely gave him a glance. When they looked curiously at Holden, pushing two injured people on the same bed, he said,
"Two to a bed now. That's how crowded we're getting."
They just nodded and passed, their expressions both sullen and bored. Holden hadn't had much chance to look around the rest of the hospital. After leaving the docks, he'd hurried straight to his crew's room and hadn't left since. But now, as he moved through the halls and intersections toward the exit,
He had a chance to look over the full extent of the damage the catastrophic speed limit change had caused.